And now, America's number one show on pop culture and politics. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. A great day in a great nation where there is great and bitter debate concerning what happens next in the war on Gaza. The ambiguous response to the telephone call between President Biden and Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu, where there's basically a suggestion that America will change policies unless Israel changes its policies in pursuing an end to the Gaza war. How would America change policies? Would this eliminate America's aid to Israel? Aid which is extraordinarily important to the Israelis, despite the fact that Prime Minister Netanyahu has said, if there is any interruption in aid, we will go it alone. The determination on part of the Israeli leadership right now is that even with pressure from the United States and the rest of the world, a lot of it having to do with an accident of war, among, by the way, many accidents of war. Why is this accident of war look so much incredibly worse than others? Partially because Israel has very publicly tried to hold itself to a higher standard and has tried to indicate that they will continue to go to great efforts, even risking the lives of soldiers in the IDF, to try to spare as many civilians as possible. There's a powerful and I think necessary column that appeared today in the Wall Street Journal about Hamas's number games. Now, what number games, you may ask about? The fact is that whenever people talk about what is going on in the war in Gaza, they always use the same figures, and the figures are from the Hamas Health Ministry. But where do those figures really come from? There's a researcher named David Desnick, and he is a director of research at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, which is actually a pretty wonderful organization that talks about the embattled fight in of Israel to survive as the only democratic nation in that region of the world, and the desire of Ukraine to survive and to try to please allow the Speaker of the House to begin to keep some of his promises and bring that Ukraine aid to the floor of the House of Representatives. Got 70 votes in the Senate. In any event, the new piece by David Desnick is about those figures you always hear from the Hamas Ministry of Health. What do they mean? Where do the numbers really come from? As Israeli troops batter Hamas and drive its surviving forces to the southern edge of the Gaza Strip, the Gaza Health Ministry, he writes, has etched in the public mind a statistic that casts Israel's war of self-defense as a bloodbath. 70% of the dead in Gaza are women and children, they say. That's what the Hamas-run Ministry of Health says. And more than 30,000 lives in total have been lost. Is any of it true? President Biden, who pledged in October that Israel would never stand alone, has recently talked about red lines to prevent the Jewish state from eliminating Hamas's final stronghold because, as Mr. Biden put it, they cannot have another 30,000 Palestinians dead. Mr. Biden isn't alone in taking Hamas's numbers at face value. The United Nations also relies on the health ministry's data. The U.S. news media include the ministry's latest numbers in their daily updates on the war. In October, the Washington Post's Adam Taylor vouched for Hamas, writing, "Many experts consider the figures provided by the ministry reliable, given its access, sources, and accuracy in past statements." Yet in a series of lengthy reports, the ministry admits that the figures that the media treat as authoritative rely in part on reporting from the media, and not just the American media, but primarily sources like Al Jazeera that clearly have an agenda that is very different from simply delivering the truth. The ministry says its casualty counts include two types of fatalities: those recorded by medical facilities and those reported by, quote, reliable media sources. In its March 31st report, the ministry attributes 15,070% of the dead, or nearly half, to news reports. From which outlets? The ministry never says. And this is a very serious matter because it leads to all kinds of very strange numbers. For instance, an enterprising correspondent with a willingness to question the dominant narrative could easily have found and translated the reports that they say they are using. And there are reports, again, from Arab-based media sources. And when he talks about translating, it's about translating from Arabic. Gabriel Epstein, an analyst at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, did this soon after the ministry, health ministry, published its first statistical report in December. He found that the deaths attributed to, quote, reliable media sources consisted almost entirely of women and children. Of the 6,629 fatalities attributed to media, in other words, they claimed that they had gotten these numbers from the media, how many were men, adult men? This is out of 6,629 deaths, 10. Now, what that would mean, if that were even close to being true, it would mean that the Israeli forces are, for some reason, trying to exempt male victims, or all the men have simply run away. But you're talking about such a tiny percentage who are men, and most of whom are listed here, listed as children. Over time, media reports have accounted for an ever larger share of the ministry's data. Of nearly 11,000 fatalities reported between January 1st and March 31st, the ministry derived 78% from media reports. Adult males account for only 9% of all fatalities attributed to the news. Even though Gaza's sex ratio is close to even, and more than half its residents are adults. If one removes the questionable data from the ministry numbers, it becomes clear that Israel has made considerable efforts to minimize the war's effect on civilians, while Hamas continues to use hospitals as fortresses. Instead of drawing so-called red lines for a U.S. ally, as if it were a threat to American values and interests, Mr. Biden should encourage Israel to dispatch Hamas swiftly, since the terror group has brought nothing but misery to Gazans and Israelis alike. We'll be speaking to Paul Kenger about the political impact of Gaza, debates about Ukraine, and anti-Semitism on campus. Coming up on The Medved Show.
The Michael Medved Show.
I'm just shocked.
More of Michael Medved in a moment.
And on the Michael Medved Show, always an honor to welcome back to this show Professor Paul Kengor, who is a professor of political science at Grove City College in Grove City, Pennsylvania. He is also senior director and chief academic fellow for the Institute for Faith and Freedom. And he's also the editor of The Spectator, which is an important voice in the conservative universe. And the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College is back with its annual conference after the interruptions caused by the pandemic. And that conference is taking place, well, beginning on April 11th, so it's 6 days from now. And this is an unusual topic for Grove City to take on, because it's something where Grove City actually could provide perhaps a model to other campuses that are facing a new plague of anti-Semitism. In terms of this conference, which is bringing scholars really from around the world to talk about this issue, have you been personally surprised at the rise in public expressions of anti-Semitic attitudes since the attack on Israel?
Well, unfortunately, I haven't, Michael, because I'm not surprised by anything that I see on college campuses, right? And, you know, the campuses are just hotbeds of left-wing radicalism. And among the American left, there's this rising anti-Semitism even before the Hamas attacks on October 7th, 2023. And you would think that Israel attacked Hamas with the way that these campuses have risen up. But amazingly, so Hamas launches this brutal terrorist attack on October 7th on you know, completely innocent Israeli civilians who are just at a concert, basically. And Israel responds to this. And what does the American left do on campuses? They rise up not in protest of Hamas, but of Israel. And a lot of the anti-Israel sentiment by these people, it's not just anti-Israel, not just like anti-Netanyahu or against Israel's response, but it's been very clear that a lot of it, Michael, it's just downright anti-Semitic. And that's not new. I mean, anti-Semitism has been around for thousands of years. Any Christian can just, pick up his Bible, read the Old Testament, and see that. But I'm not surprised by anything I see from the left. And at Grove City College, we're different. And we thought this was a really good chance to show that by bringing people in from around the country to address not just this new rise in anti-Semitism, but historical anti-Semitism. So you're going to be here, which is great. We're looking forward to it. We have Naomi Schaefer Riley Naomi Riley Schaefer of the Wall Street Journal, George Weigel, the biographer of Pope John Paul II. He has a lot of interesting insights on this. He talks about the sin of anti-Semitism, as he calls it. We're opening up with Paul Packer and David Pfeiffer, two friends of mine who were there in Israel that morning, October 7th, when it happened. Deborah Goldman of the Ethics and Public Policy Center, Rabbi Meir Soloveitchik, and we also have Mike Pence, of all people, former Vice President of the United States, no less, who has been just a stalwart defender of Israel for a long, long time. So we got a great group. Yeah,
Mike Pence is a terrific choice. And again, people in Israel have a great deal of confidence in and affection for Vice President Pence. Early in the Trump administration, Vice President Pence made a trip to Israel, spoke before a Knesset session, and was extremely well received. I mean, people felt that he got it very directly in terms of Israel's struggle for existence. So about Grove City College, does Grove City have either an organized pro-Palestinian presence or an organized Jewish presence among students?
Well, definitely not an organized pro-Palestinian contingent at all. And with our students, I wouldn't even say it's organized pro-Israel. It's just naturally pro-Israel. And I mean, at any given time since I've been here, all the way back to 1997, there are always students that are making pilgrimages to the Holy Land, to Jerusalem, and going over there with different ecumenical groups, different Christian groups, Jewish groups. So it's always been a very natural thing. And by the way, I should add, our closing talk next Thursday at the conference will be my talk, and I'm speaking on FDR, Truman, and the creation of the modern nation of Israel. And I think people are going to be really interested in this, surprised by some of it. You won't, because you know this history. But FDR was very anti-Semitic, and a number of his different pro-Zionist, so-called, advisors, like David Niles, would later say that had FDR lived, he had doubts about whether or not the nation of Israel would have even come into existence in 1948. But instead, FDR died April 1945. He was replaced by Harry Truman. And thank God, literally, for Harry Truman, because Truman was almost alone in his administration in leading the United States to the recognition of Israel. And in Truman's own life, he has statements that some think are anti-Semitic, or at the very least, I mean, Truman just used a lot of ethnic language about all sorts of other groups, too. But there couldn't have been a better friend of Israel at that time. So I'm going to go over that kind of crucial historical information that I don't think a lot of Americans are aware of.
Again, this is all terrific that you're doing this, and with such an outstanding collection of people, and I look forward to it very much. I'm hoping to speak about the long history of the opposite of anti-Semitism, which is philo-Semitism, which is identification with and concern for and sympathy for the Jewish people, and that history going back to the very beginnings of the Republic. With people like John Adams expressing a wish to help the Jewish people come back and reestablish a Jewish homeland. Adams wrote about that in 1816, which is obviously it's more than 100 years before even the Balfour Declaration. We will be right back with some political news in Pennsylvania. It's surprising political news. I mean, it's extremely surprising concerning a new Franklin Marshall College poll. We'll be talking about that from Pennsylvania with Paul Kangor of Grove City College and the Institute for Faith and Freedom. We'll be right back.
We need to deal with the truth.
The Michael Medved Show. More of Michael Medved in a moment.
There's a couple of new surveys that are worth attention. There's a new survey that shows that 87% of Jewish parents say that rising anti-Semitism now impacts the college selection for their children. And, you know, it's so ironic because last night I had a conversation with someone who was close to me, who has a daughter who is just beginning college next year. And he was asking me about the same thing, concerned about the same thing. His daughter is just completing a program in Israel, a gap year program between us, and she has a number of choices. And certainly one of the choices that, if it weren't geographically challenging, Grove City College in Grove City, Pennsylvania, where the senior director and chief academic fellow of the Faith and Freedom, Institute for Faith and Freedom. Paul Kangor is with us. Paul, the second element of a new survey that I wanted to ask you about is a Franklin and Marshall College poll that just came out, and it's a horse race, they say, between President Trump and President Biden in a 2024 general election matchup. This is of registered Pennsylvania voters, and it was released yesterday. In this poll, it shows support for Biden from 48% of voters and Trump's 38%. Meanwhile, 13% of voters surveyed said they preferred to vote for someone else. Good luck for Robert Kennedy Jr. But what do you make about this Biden bounce in Pennsylvania? What's that about?
Yeah, I mean, that is really an outlier. I mean, that's an anomaly. I have not seen any other polls like that. I would say throw it out. I mean, I'm sure that it was done in, you know, the way Franklin Marshall usually does these things, you know, scientifically and with a typical representative sample size that statisticians go for. But 10%, I mean, up until that, in fact, I think Real Clear Politics yesterday had Trump over Biden by 0.1 or 0.2 in Pennsylvania. It was very slim. It wouldn't have been higher than 1%. And the distance between these two has been no more than either a 1% lead for Biden or 1% for Trump. It's been very, very close. And in 2016, of course, Trump won Pennsylvania by less than 1%. And then in 2020, Biden won it by less than 1%. So 10%, I mean, there's just no way. That can't be possible. And it's ironic that that's put out because I'm right now on my way to the annual Pennsylvania Leadership Conference in Harrisburg, which runs from Thursday until Saturday. And it's like a Pennsylvania version of CPAC. So that poll is going to be it's going to be making a lot of buzz around the conservative faithful there, most of which aren't going to believe it, but they're going to be probably a little shaken.
They will probably have more confidence in a Fox News poll, where in the Fox News poll, it also shows President Biden in the lead in Pennsylvania, but by much less. President Biden led former President Donald Trump by just 2 points in a new poll of Pennsylvania registered voters, despite the enduring belief of many that he is too old to serve as the chief executive for another term. Biden pulled ahead of Trump in a new Franklin and Marshall poll released on Thursday. Pennsylvania is one of the critical battleground states. I believe that there are only two Democratic presidents who have won election to the presidency in the modern era without carrying Pennsylvania. With 20 electoral votes, it's absolutely crucial, no?
It's crucial. It's probably among the swing states, one of the top two or three most important swing states. Now, I mean, we're right next door to Ohio, and in fact, where I live in Grove City, Pennsylvania, we're about 24 miles from the border of Ohio, and Ohio is really not even listed as a swing state anymore. It's so decisively Republican, and Trump will probably win it by 7 or 8 points. But the other swing states, Florida used to be listed as one, but that should easily go for Trump. North Carolina probably will go for Trump. Trump's up in Georgia by quite a bit, I think 5-7%, although he lost it in 2020. Wisconsin and Michigan and Pennsylvania, Nevada even, Arizona, those are all states that could probably go either way. And
The election is up for grabs. No one on either side should say that this is a sealed deal. And speaking of sealed deals, you and I spoke about it before. John Fetterman, who is the junior senator from Pennsylvania, he's not up. He's not on the ballot this time because he won his seat in 2022. And he has been a little bit of a surprise, particularly on Israel. Listen to what Senator Fetterman said on CBS.
It's absolutely tragic. It's heartbreaking. And, you know, I don't assign any more value in the life of a Palestinian child than my own children. And I see that kind of a pain. And it's a war, and it's absolutely terrible. What's going on and where Hamas now is hiding behind civilians and things, and Israel has, you said, that they have the right to defend themselves and to destroy Hamas. I think that's critical.
At what point do you say we have to come up with another strategy that at least keeps the innocent, the women and the children, safe?
It very is important to minimize the kind of collateral damage and protecting civilization lives as well. And I would hope that Hamas decides to not starting to hide behind civilians and creating those circumstances that makes it even more difficult as well.
But that seems to be their strategy too, Senator, to hide behind. You know?
Yeah, that is their strategy. And now even in hospitals or in the tunnels and everything. And we also can't forget about the hostages as well too. They've been now in custody now since October 7th. So it's an awful situation. And you don't have to agree with every leader's views. But, you know, we have an opportunity to stand with Israel in this situation, and that's what I've decided to do.
Okay. Have you been surprised by how strong he seems to be on this issue?
And I'll tell you, so Fetterman is a Western Pennsylvania guy. He's a Pittsburgher. He was actually mayor of Braddock, which is kind of like a little borough outside of Pittsburgh. And in some ways, he has fairly conservative instincts, although he has these liberal positions on social cultural issues, right? Marijuana, abortion, gay marriage, that kind of thing. So he does have, you know, some degree of common sense, and he seems to be applying the common sense there. I wish he would talk to Joe Biden. He probably ought to go talk to Joe Biden right now because he's making a lot more sense than Joe Biden is on Israel, that's for sure.
Well, again, I'm glad he is there, frankly, because the Democratic Party is deeply divided on this issue, as people can see. And the Republican Party, however, remains solid. And there should be solid anticipation for a great conference at Grove City College, which is coming up. I can't believe it. It's next week. And I look forward, Paul Kangor, to seeing you there and in person. Coming back on the Michael Medved Show, we promised we would get to it, and we will. What is on the DJT playlist? That's not just three initials. That's DJ as in DEEGAYT. Donald John Trump, his playlist. We'll get to it on the Medved Show.
The Michael Medved Show.
With all due respect, that's the most ridiculous thing I ever heard.
This is the Michael Medved Show. More of Michael Medved in a moment.
You can't always get what you want has been played literally hundreds of times at Trump rallies. And I've often wondered why. In other words, when you're doing a rally and you're promising people, you want to give them what they want. But you're trying to remind them you can't always get what you want. President Trump flat out loves the song. There's a new piece in Axios. And the headline says, Trump's Mar-a-Lago Spotify playlist explains his mind, friends say. And it says that at his Oceanside retreat in Palm Beach, that would be Mar-a-Lago, Trump controls the surround sound stereo system on the breezy dining patio with his big iPad and Spotify list. Regulars jokingly call it the DJT performance. get it, DJT, as in Donald John Trump. Whether Trump's in office or out, there's an unchanging patio scene at Mar-a-Lago. The regulars all know each other, they write, and feel free to drop by Trump's table. But there's sometimes a velvet rope next to Trump's chair. But it more signifies his throne of honor than keeping anyone away. Members tell him how great he's doing. He'll often show them a printout of a poll that shows him as the greatest. The hotelier in Trump is very proud of the dinner buffet. He pushes the specials. But it's the musical ritual that really captures Trump. He alone controls the volume. Most nights when he's at home, he walks downstairs at the ground floor of Mar-a-Lago. Like clockwork, the crowd rises in applause, greeting the guest of honor, and sometimes complimenting his ear for music. Trump shakes hands as people pass his table near the front. After dinner, he'll open his iPad and play the hits. Sometimes it's so loud that people have trouble talking. He marvels at the sound quality filling the garden. The same is true at his campaign events. He has no interest in switching topics, tone, or volume. He's wholly content controlling the same playlist. And then they get to the essence of this revelatory piece. The songs stay the same. At Mar-a-Lago and on the patio of his golf club in Bedminster, New Jersey, the music is always big names and songs people recognize, a member of his inner circle tells us. It's Trump's golden oldies, Phantom of the Opera, Jesus Christ Superstar. Maybe someone should do Donald Trump Superstar. It fits. I mean, again, given all the Jesus comparisons recently. And then there's lots of Elvis, including Suspicious Minds, Hello by Lionel Richie, Guns N' Roses, November Rain, and the duet by James Brown and Luciano Pavarotti, It's a Man's, Man's, Man's World. James Brown and Luciano Pavarotti, they didn't dance together, I don't think. Sinead O'Connor's Nothing Compares to You is a favorite. R.E.M. snuck in a couple of weeks ago. Elton John, another favorite. At Bedminster, Trump even kept the tune spinning, wearing a Make America Great Again baseball cap the night he learned of his first federal indictment. Yay! In the classified documents case, the New York Times reported. His campaign rallies and interviews are no different. The playlist rarely shifts. The election was stolen. Well, that's always been a hit. The deep state hates him. Build the wall. Biden is senile. And true oldies, lock her up. Unlike other politicians, he doesn't pivot or mix up his speech topics very much. That's why his rallies often feel like reruns. I think it's wrong to say they feel like reruns. It feels like ritual. I mean, you go to church or synagogue, you kind of hear the same thing week after week, don't you? That's ritual. It's reassuring. His excitement never fades, they write. He seems like a kid with a new toy every time he turns on the iPad. It feels like the first time he's heard or shared the crooning of Sinatra or the life hard lived edge of Cash. Same at rallies. He's been playing the same tunes for 8 years and never tires of it, even when others beg him, please change the station or try to follow the teleprompter. He'll never change. One friend explaining the Spotify spectacle said Trump's brain is a series of titanium tubes filled with a specific set of grievances, crowd-pleasing lines, and taunts. The pipes are impenetrable. No matter the topic or the tune, you always end up stuck in one. He's the same in interviews. No matter what you ask, Trump often simply opens one of the tubes and riffs. The bottom line, one of Trump's playlist favorites is the Rolling Stones' You Can't Always Get What You Want. But most nights, Trump's trusty iPad grants him his every wish. Okay, does any of this seem surprising? There was a surprising comment by Arnold Schwarzenegger. And Arnold Schwarzenegger, one of the things that got him elected successfully as the last Republican governor of California, the last winner in a statewide contest. Steve Garvey, the baseball star, is in the Senate race against Adam Schiff in November coming up. But I'm not sure he has a realistic chance. The polls are tough in California. But Schwarzenegger was speaking on the New Heights podcast with the Kelce brothers. That's Travis and Jason Kelce, football stars. And he was talking about people coming to America. Listen, this is clip four.
To me, coming to America was the key to my success. It's just a place where foreigners are welcomed. And this is the key thing. If you are willing to contribute to America, there's a lot of people that want to come to America to take advantage of America. And I am very vividly against that.
Okay. What's interesting is everybody's... What is an example of someone coming to America to take advantage of America? And if you are looking for a job, is that taking advantage? I do believe that they have made progress over the years in trying to cut off benefits, welfare benefits, or giveaways that government offers too often and too easily and without the proper controls. And then obviously you take advantage of America if you come here and you make no effort to legalize your own status, to get work permits, to open up your own opportunities. But part of the challenge has been part of any immigration reform should discriminate between people who want to benefit from coming to America, but want to do it the right way, which does mean, of course, following the rules. And that's something that that Schwarzenegger was obviously fairly clear about. We're talking about pop music before. 30 years ago today, Kurt Cobain died. And MTV's Kurt Loder broke the news of Kurt Cobain's passing on April 5th, 1994. We will get to that and get to more on Bernie Sanders taking a truly militant anti-Israel position on CNN. And we will also be dealing with some of the new movies. There are two of them involving Oscar winners. Sean Penn, star of one, Olivia Colman, the star of the other. Very different films, but we'll tell you whether either is worthy of this greatest nation on God's green earth.